Welcome to this week's Classic and Contemporary Short Stories program. I'm Linda Primavera, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. The first story is from the Treasury of American Short Stories, edited by Nancy Sullivan. I always wanted you to admire my fasting, or Looking at Kafka, by Philip Roth. To the students of English 275, University of Pennsylvania, Fall, 1972. I always wanted you to admire my fasting, said the hunger artist. We do admire it, said the overseer affably, but you shouldn't admire it, said the hunger artist. Well, then we don't admire it, said the overseer, but why shouldn't we admire it? Because I have to fast, I can't help it, said the hunger artist. What a fellow you are, said the overseer, and why can't you help it? Because, said the hunger artist, lifting his head a little and speaking with his lips pursed, as if for a kiss, right into the overseer's ear, so that no syllable might be lost, because I couldn't find the food I liked. If I had found it, believe me, I should have made no fuss and stuffed myself like you or anyone else. These were his last words, but in his dimming eyes remained the firm, though no longer proud, persuasion that he was still continuing to fast. A hunger artist. Franz Kafka. 1. I am looking, as I write of Kafka, at the photograph taken of him at the age of 40, my age. It is 1924, as sweet and hopeful a year as he may ever have known as a man, and the year of his death. His face is sharp and skeletal, a burrower's face, pronounced cheekbones made even more conspicuous by the absence of sideburns, the ears shaped and angled on his head like angel wings, an intense creaturely gaze of startled composure, enormous fears, enormous control. A black towel of levantine hair pulled close around the skull, the only sensuous feature. There is a familiar Jewish flare in the bridge of the nose. The nose itself is long and weighted slightly at the tip, the nose of half the Jewish boys who were my friends in high school. Skulls chiseled like this one were shoveled by the thousands from the ovens. Had he lived, his would have been among them, along with the skulls of his three younger sisters. Of course, it is no more horrifying to think of Franz Kafka in Auschwitz than it is to think of anyone in Auschwitz. To paraphrase Tolstoy, it is just horrifying in its own way. But he died too soon for the Holocaust. Had he lived, perhaps he would have escaped with his good friend and great advocate Max Brod, who eventually found refuge in Palestine, a citizen of Israel until his death there in 1970. But Kafka escaping? It seems unlikely for one so fascinated by entrapment and careers that culminate in anguished death. Still, there is Carl Rossman, his American greenhorn. Having imagined Carl's escape to America and his mixed luck here, could not Kafka have found a way to execute an escape for himself? The new School for Social Research in New York becoming his great nature theater of Oklahoma? Or perhaps through the influence of Thomas Mann, a position in the German department at Princeton? But then, had Kafka lived, it is not at all certain that the books of his, which Mann celebrated from his refuge in New Jersey, would ever have been published. Eventually, Kafka might either have destroyed those manuscripts that he had once bid Max Brod to dispose of at his death, or, at the least, continued to keep them his secret. The Jewish refugee arriving in America in 1938 would not then have been Mann's religious humorist, but a frail and bookish 55-year-old bachelor, formerly a lawyer for a government insurance firm in Prague, retired on a pension in Berlin at the time of Hitler's rise to power. An author, yes, but of a few eccentric stories, mostly about animals, stories no one in America had ever heard of and only a handful in Europe had read. A homeless Kay, but without Kay's willfulness and purpose. A homeless Carl, but without Carl's youthful spirit and resilience. Just a Jew lucky enough to have escaped with his life, in his possession a suitcase containing some clothes, some family photos, some Prague mementos, and the manuscripts, still unpublished and in pieces, of America, The Trial, The Castle, and, stranger things happen, three more fragmented novels, no less remarkable than the bizarre masterworks that he keeps to himself out of Oedipal timidity, perfectionist madness, and insatiable longings for solitude and spiritual purity. July 1923. 11 months before he will die in a Vienna sanatorium, Kafka somehow finds the resolve to leave Prague and his father's home for good. Never before has he even remotely succeeded in living apart, independent of his mother, his sisters, and his father. Nor has he been a writer other than in those few hours when he's not working in the legal department of the Workers' Accident Insurance Office in Prague. Since taking his law degree at the university, he has been, by all reports, the most dutiful and scrupulous of employees, though he finds the work tedious and enervating. But in June of 1923, having some months earlier been pensioned from his job because of his illness, he meets a young Jewish girl of 19 at a seaside resort in Germany, Dora Diamant, an employee at the vacation camp of the Jewish People's Home of Berlin. Dora has left her Orthodox Polish family to make a life of her own, at half Kafka's age. She and Kafka, who has just turned 40, fall in love. Kafka has by now been engaged to two somewhat more conventional Jewish girls, twice to one of them, hectic, anguished engagements wrecked largely by his fears. "I am mentally incapable of marrying," he writes his father in the 45-page letter he gave to his mother to deliver. "The moment I make up my mind to marry, I can no longer sleep. My head burns day and night. Life can no longer be called life." He explains why. "Marrying is barred to me," he tells his father, "because it is your domain. Sometimes I imagine the map of the world spread out and you stretch diagonally across it, and I feel as if I could consider living in only those regions that either are not covered by you or are not within your reach. And in keeping with the conception I have of your magnitude, these are not many and not very comforting regions, and marriage is not among them." The letter explaining what is wrong between this father and this son is dated November 1919. The mother thought it best not even to deliver it, perhaps for lack of courage, probably like the son for lack of hope. During the following 2 years, Kafka attempts to wage an affair with Milena Jesenska-Polak, an intense young woman of 24 who has translated a few of his stories into Czech and is mostly unhappily married in Vienna. His affair with Milena, conducted feverishly but by and large through the mails, is even more demoralizing to Kafka than the fearsome engagements to the nice Jewish girls. They aroused only the paterfamilias longings that he dared not indulge, longings inhibited by his exaggerated awe of his father. Spellbound, says Broad, in the family circle, and the hypnotic spell of his own solitude, but the Czech Milena, impetuous, frenetic, indifferent to conventional restraints, a woman of appetite and anger, arouses more elemental yearnings and more elemental fears. According to a Prague critic, Rio Preisner, Milena was psychopathic, according to Margaret Buber Neumann, who lived 2 years beside her in the German concentration camp where Milena died following a kidney operation in 1944. She was powerfully sane, extraordinarily humane and courageous. Milena's obituary for Kafka was the only one of consequence to appear in the Prague press. The prose is strong, so are the claims she makes for Kafka's accomplishment. She is still only in her 20s. The dead man is hardly known as a writer beyond his small circle of friends. Yet Milena writes, "His knowledge of the world was exceptional and deep, and he was a deep and exceptional world in himself. He had a delicacy of feeling bordering on the miraculous and a mental clarity that was terrifyingly uncompromising, and in turn he loaded on to his illness the whole burden of his mental fear of life. He wrote the most important books in recent German literature." One can imagine this vibrant young woman stretched diagonally across the bed, as awesome to Kafka as his own father spread out across the map of the world. His letters to her are disjointed, unlike anything else of his in print. The word fear, frequently emphasized, appears on page after page. "We are both married, you in Vienna, I to my fear in Prague." He yearns to lay his head upon her breast. He calls her Mother Milena. During at least one of their two brief rendezvous, he is hopelessly impotent. At last he has to tell her to leave him be, an edict that Milena honors, though it leaves her hollow with grief. "Do not write," Kafka tells her, "and let us not see each other. I ask you only to quietly fulfill this request of mine. Only on those conditions is survival possible for me. Everything else continues the process of destruction." Then in the early summer of 1923, during a visit to his sister who is vacationing with her children by the Baltic Sea, he finds young Dora Diamant, and within a month Franz Kafka has gone off to live with her in two rooms in a suburb of Berlin, out of reach at last of the claws of Prague and home. How can it be? How can he in his illness have accomplished so swiftly and decisively the leave-taking that was so beyond him in his healthiest days? The impassioned letter writer who could equivocate interminably about which train to catch to Vienna to meet with Milena, if he should meet with her for the weekend at all, the bourgeois suitor in the high collar who, during his drawn-out agony of an engagement with the proper Fräulein Bauer, secretly draws up a memorandum for himself countering the arguments for marriage with the arguments against, the poet of the ungraspable and the unresolved, whose belief in the immovable barrier separating the wish from its realization is at the heart of his excruciating visions of defeat, the Kafka whose fictions refute every easy, touching, humanish daydream of salvation and justice and fulfillment with densely imagined counter-dreams that mock all solutions and escapes. This Kafka escapes. Overnight, K penetrates the castle walls. Joseph K evades his indictment, a breaking away from it altogether, a mode of living completely outside the jurisdiction of the court. Yes, the possibility of which Joseph K has just a glimmering in the cathedral, but can neither fathom nor effectuate. Not some influential manipulation of the case, but a circumvention of it, Kafka realizes in the last year of his life. Was it Dora Diamond, or was it death that pointed the new way? Perhaps it could not have been one without the other. We know that the illusory emptiness at which Kay gazed upon first entering the village and looking up through the mist and the darkness to the castle was no more vast and incomprehensible than was the idea of himself as husband and father to the young Kafka. But now it seems the prospect of a Dora forever, of a wife, home, and children everlasting, is no longer the terrifying, bewildering prospect it would once have been. For now everlasting is undoubtedly not much more than a matter of months. Yes, the dying Kafka is determined to marry and writes to Dora's orthodox father for his daughter's hand. But the imminent death that has resolved all contradictions and uncertainties in Kafka is the very obstacle placed in his path by the young girl's father. The request of Franz Kafka, a dying man, to bind to him in his invalidism Dora Diamond, a healthy young girl, is denied. If there is not one father standing in Kafka's way, there is another, and to be sure, another beyond him. Dora's father, writes Max Brod in his biography of Kafka, set off with Kafka's letter to consult the man he honored most, whose authority counted more than anything else for him, the Gerer Rabbi. The rabbi read the letter, put it to one side, and said nothing more than the single syllable, "No." No! Clam himself could have been no more abrupt or any more removed from the petitioner. No, in its harsh finality, as telling and inescapable as a curse-like threat delivered by his father to George Bendeman, that thwarted fiancé, "Just take your bride on your arm and try getting in my way. I'll sweep her from your very side. You don't know how." No, thou shalt not have, say the fathers, and Kafka agrees that he shall not. The habit of obedience and renunciation, also his own distaste for the diseased and reverence for strength, appetite, and health. "Well, clear this out now," said the overseer, and they buried the hunger artist, straw and all. Into the cage they put a young panther. Even the most insensitive felt it refreshing to see this wild creature leaping around the cage that had so long been dreary. The panther was all right. The food he liked was brought him without hesitation by the attendants. He seemed not even to miss his freedom. His noble body, furnished almost to the bursting point with all that it needed, seemed to carry freedom around with it, too. Somewhere in his jaws it seemed to lurk, and the joy of life streamed with such ardent passion from his throat that for the onlookers it was not easy to stand the shock of it. But they braced themselves, crowded around the cage, and did not want ever to move away. So no was no, he knew as much himself. A healthy young girl of 19 cannot, should not, be given in matrimony to a sickly man twice her age who spits up blood. "I sentence you," cries George Bendeman's father, "to death by drowning," and shakes in his bed with fevers and chills. What sort of un-Kafka-like dream had Kafka been dreaming? and those 9 months spent with Dora have still other Kafkaesque elements. A fierce winter in quarters inadequately heated, the inflation that makes a pittance of his own meager pension and sends into the streets of Berlin the hungry and needy, whose suffering, says Dora, turned Kafka ash gray, and his tubercular lungs flesh transformed and punished. Dora cares as devotedly and tenderly for the diseased writer as does Gregor Samsa's sister for her brother, the bug. Gregor's sister plays the violin so beautifully that Gregor felt as if the way were opening before him to the unknown nourishment he craved. He dreams in his condition of sending his gifted sister to the conservatory. Dora's music is Hebrew, which she reads aloud to Kafka, and with such skill that, according to Broad, Franz recognized her dramatic talent. On his advice and under his direction, she later educated herself in the art. Only Kafka is hardly vermin to Dora Diamond, or to himself. Away from Prague and his father's home, Kafka, in his 40th year, seems at last to have been delivered from the self-loathing, the self-doubt, and those guilt-ridden impulses to dependence and self-effacement that had nearly driven him mad throughout his 20s and 30s. All at once, he seems to have shed the pervasive sense of hopeless despair that informs the great punitive fantasies of the trial, the penal colony, and the metamorphosis. Years earlier in Prague, he had directed Max Brod to destroy all his papers, including 3 unpublished novels, upon his death. Now, in Berlin, where Brod introduces him to a German publisher interested in his work, Kafka consents to the publication of a volume of 4 stories, and consents, says Brod, without much need of long arguments to persuade him. With Dora to help, he diligently resumes his study of Hebrew. Despite his illness in the harsh winter, he travels to the Berlin Academy for Jewish Studies to attend a series of lectures on the Talmud. A very different Kafka from the estranged melancholic who once wrote in his diary, "What have I in common with the Jews? I have hardly anything in common with myself and should stand very quietly in a corner, content that I can breathe." And to further mark the change, there is ease and happiness with a woman. With this young and adoring companion, he is playful, he is pedagogical, and one would guess, in light of his illness and his happiness, he is chaste. If not a husband, such he had striven to be to the conventional Fräulein Bauer, if not a lover, as he struggled hopelessly to be with Milena, he would seem to have become something no less miraculous in his scheme of things. A father, a kind of father to this sisterly, mothering daughter. As Franz Kafka awoke one morning from uneasy dreams, he found himself transformed in his bed into a father, a writer, and a Jew. "I have completed the construction of my burrow," begins the long, exquisite, and tedious story that he wrote that winter in Berlin, "and it seems to be successful. Just the place where, according to my calculations, the castle keep should be. The soil was very loose and sandy and had literally to be hammered and pounded into a firm state to serve as a wall for the beautifully vaulted chamber. But for such tasks, the only tool I possess is my forehead. So I had to run with my forehead thousands and thousands of times, for whole days and nights, against the ground. And I was glad when the blood came, for that was proof that the walls were beginning to harden. In that way, as everybody must admit, I richly paid for my castle keep. The burrow is a story of an animal with a keen sense of peril whose life is organized around the principle of defense, and whose deepest longings are for security and serenity. With teeth and claws and forehead, the burrower constructs an elaborate and ingeniously intricate system of underground chambers and corridors that are designed to afford it some peace of mind. However, while this burrow does succeed in reducing the sense of danger from without, its maintenance and protection are equally fraught with anxiety. These anxieties are different from ordinary ones, prouder, richer in content, often long repressed, but in their destructive effects they are perhaps much the same as the anxieties that existence in the outer world gives rise to. The story, whose ending is lost, terminates with the burrower fixated upon distant subterranean noises that cause it to assume the existence of a great beast, itself burrowing in the direction of the castle keep. Another grim tale of entrapment and of obsession so absolute that no distinction is possible between character and predicament. Yet this fiction, imagined in the last happy months of his life, is touched with a spirit of personal reconciliation and sardonic self-acceptance, with a tolerance for one's old brand of madness that is not apparent in The Metamorphosis, the piercing masochistic irony of the early animal story, as of the judgment and the trial, has given way here to a critique of the self and its preoccupations that, though bordering on mockery, no longer seeks to resolve itself in images of the uttermost humiliation and defeat. But there is more here than a metaphor for the insanely defended ego, whose striving for invulnerability produces a defensive system that must in its turn become the object of perpetual concern. There is also a very unromantic and hard-headed fable about how and why art is made, a portrait of the artist in all his ingenuity, anxiety, isolation, dissatisfaction, relentlessness, obsessiveness, secretiveness, paranoia, and self-addiction, a portrait of the magical thinker at the end of his tether, Kafka's Prospero. It is an infinitely suggestive story, the story of life in a whole. For finally, remember the proximity of Dora Diamond during the months that Kafka was at work on the Burrow, in the two underheated rooms that was their illicit home. Certainly a dreamer like Kafka need never have entered the young girl's body for her tender presence to kindle in him a fantasy of a hidden orifice that promises satisfied desire, achieved ambition, and profound slumber, but that once penetrated and in one's possession arouses the most terrifying and heartbreaking fears of retribution and loss. For the rest, I try to unriddle the beast's plans. Is it on its wanderings, or is it working on its own burrow? If it is on its wanderings, then perhaps an understanding with it might be possible. If it should really break through to the burrow, I shall give it some of my stores, and it will go on its way again. It will go on its way again. A fine story. Lying in my heap of earth, I can naturally dream of all sorts of things, even of an understanding with the beast, though I know well enough that no such thing can happen, and that at the instant when we see each other, more, at the moment when we merely guess at each other's presence, we shall blindly bare our claws and teeth. He died of tuberculosis of the lungs and the larynx a month short of his 41st birthday, June 3, 1924. Dora, inconsolable, whispers for days afterward, my love, my good one. 2. 1942. I am 9. My Hebrew school teacher, Dr. Kafka, is 59. To the little boys who must attend his 4-to-5 class each afternoon, he is known, in part because of his remote and melancholy foreignness, but largely because we vent on him our resentment at having to learn an ancient calligraphy at the very hour we should be out screaming our heads off in the ball field. He is known as Dr. Kishka, named, I confess, by me. His sour breath, spiced with intestinal juices by 5 in the afternoon, makes a Yiddish word for insides particularly telling, I think. Cruel, yes, but in truth, I would have cut out my tongue had I ever imagined the name would become legend. A coddled child, I do not yet think of myself as persuasive, nor quite yet as a literary force in the world. My jokes don't hurt. How could they? I'm so adorable. And if you don't believe me, just ask my family and the teachers in school. Already at 9, 1 foot in Harvard, the other in the Catskills, little borscht belt comic that I am outside the classroom, I amuse my friends Schlossman and Ratner on the dark walk home from Hebrew school with an imitation of Kishka, his finicky and precise professorial manner, his German accent, his cough, his gloom. Dr. Kishka, cries Schlossman, and hurls himself savagely against a newsstand that belongs to the candy store owner, whom Schlossman drives just a little crazier each night. Dr. Franz, Dr. Franz, Dr. Franz Kishka, screams Ratner, and my chubby little friend, who lives upstairs from me on nothing but chocolate milk and Malamars, does not stop laughing until, as is his wont, his mother has asked me to keep an eye on him for just this reason, he wets his pants. Schlossman takes the occasion of Ratner's humiliation to pull the little boy's paper out of his notebook and wave it in the air. It is the assignment Dr. Kafka has just returned to us, graded. We were told to make up an alphabet of our own, out of straight lines and curved lines and dots. That is all an alphabet is, he had explained. That is all Hebrew is. That is all English is. Straight lines and curved lines and dots. Ratner's alphabet, for which he received a C, looks like 26 skulls strung in a row. I received an A for a curlicued alphabet inspired largely, as Dr. Kafka would seem to have surmised from his comment at the top of the page, by the number 8. Schlossman received an F for forgetting even to do it, and a lot he seems to care, too. He is content, he's overjoyed with things as they are. Just waving a piece of paper in the air and screaming, Kishka! Kishka! Makes him deliriously happy. We should all be so lucky. At home, alone in the glow of my gooseneck desk lamp, plugged after dinner into an outlet in the kitchen, my study, the vision of our refugee teacher, stick-like in a fraying three-piece blue suit, is no longer very funny, particularly after the entire beginner's Hebrew class, of which I am the most studious member, takes the name Kishka to its heart. My guilt awakens redemptive fantasies of heroism. I have them often about the Jews in Europe. I must save him, if not me, who? The demonic Schlossman? The babyish Ratner? And if not now, when? For I have learned in the ensuing weeks that Dr. Kafka lives in a room in the house of an elderly Jewish lady on the shabby lower stretch of Avon Avenue, where the trolley still runs, and the poorest of Newark's Negroes shuffle meekly up and down the street, for all they seem to know, still back in Mississippi. A room! And there! My family's apartment is no palace, but it is ours at least, so long as we pay the $38.50 a month in rent. And though our neighbors are not rich, they refuse to be poor, and they refuse to be meek. Tears of shame and sorrow in my eyes, I rush into the living room to tell my parents what I have heard, though not that I heard it during a quick game of aces up played a minute before class against the synagogue's rear wall. Worse, played directly beneath a stained-glass window embossed with the names of the dead. My Hebrew teacher lives in a room. My parents go much further than I could imagine anybody going in the real world. Invite him to dinner, my mother says. Here? Of course here, Friday night. I'm sure he can stand a home-cooked meal and a little pleasant company. Meanwhile, my father gets on the phone to call my Aunt Rhoda, who lives with my grandmother and tends her and her potted plants in the apartment house at the corner of our street. For nearly 2 decades now, my father's been introducing my mother's 40-year-old baby sister to the Jewish bachelors and widowers of New Jersey. No luck so far. Aunt Rhoda, an interior decorator in the dry goods department of the Big Bear, a mammoth merchandise and produce market in Industrial Elizabeth, wears falsies. This information by way of my older brother, and sheer frilly blouses, and family lore has it that she spends hours in the bathroom every day, applying powders and sweeping her stiffish hair up into a dramatic pile on her head. But despite all this dash and display, she is, in my father's words, still afraid of the facts of life. He, however, is undaunted and administers therapy regularly and gratis. Let him squeeze you, Rhoda. It feels good. I am his flesh and blood. I can reconcile myself to such scandalous talk in our kitchen. But what will Dr. Kafka think? Oh, but it's too late to do anything now. The massive machinery of matchmaking has been set in motion by my undiscourageable father, and the smooth engines of my proud homemaking mother's hospitality are already purring away. To throw my body into the works in an attempt to bring it all to a halt, well, I might as well try to bring down the New Jersey Bell Telephone Company by leaving our receiver off the hook. Only Dr. Kafka can save me now. But to my muttered invitation, he replies, with a formal bow that turns me scarlet. Who has ever seen a person do such a thing outside of a movie house? He replies that he would be honored to be my family's dinner guest. My aunt, I rush to tell him, will be there too. It appears that I have just said something mildly humorous. Odd to see Dr. Kafka smile. Sighing, he says, I will be delighted to meet her. Meet her? He's supposed to marry her. How do I warn him? And how do I warn Aunt Rhoda, a very great admirer of me and my marks, about his sour breath, his rumors pallor, his old-world ways, so at odds with her up-to-dateness? My face feels as if it will ignite of its own and spark the fire that will engulf the synagogue, Torah, and all. When I see Dr. Kafka scrawl our address in his notebook and beneath it some words in German. Good night, Dr. Kafka. Good night, and thank you, thank you. I turn to run. I go, but not fast enough. Out on the street I hear Schlossman, that fiend, announcing to my classmates who are punching one another under the lamplight down from the synagogue steps, where a card game is also in progress, organized by the bar mitzvah boys. Roth invited Kishka to his house to eat. Does my father do a job on Kafka? Does he make a sales pitch for familial bliss? What it means to a man to have two fine boys and a wonderful wife? Can Dr. Kafka imagine what that's like? The thrill, the satisfaction, the pride? He tells our visitor of the network of relatives on his mother's side that are joined in a family association of over 250 people located in 7 states, including the state of Washington. Yes, relatives even in the far west. Here are their photographs, Dr. Kafka. This is a beautiful book we published entirely on our own for $5 a copy. Pictures of every member of the family, including infants, and a family history by Uncle Lochtblau, the 85-year-old patriarch of the clan. This is our family newsletter that is published twice a year and distributed nationwide to all the relatives. This, in the frame, is the menu from the banquet of the family association held last year in a ballroom of the Y in Newark in honor of my father's mother on her 75th birthday. My mother, Dr. Kafka learns, has served 6 consecutive years as the secretary-treasurer of the family association. My father has served a 2-year term as president, as have each of his 3 brothers. We now have 14 boys in the family in uniform. Philip writes a letter on V-mail stationery to 5 of his cousins in the army every single month. Religiously, my mother puts in, smoothing my hair. I firmly believe, says my father, that the family is a cornerstone of everything. Dr. Kafka, who has listened with close attention to my father's spiel, handling the various documents that have been passed to him with great delicacy, and poring over them with a kind of rapt absorption that reminds me of myself over the watermarks of my stamps, now for the first time expresses himself on the subject of family. Softly, he says, I agree, and inspects again the pages of our family book. Alone, says my father in conclusion, alone, Dr. Kafka, is a stone. Dr. Kafka, setting the book gently upon my mother's gleaming coffee table, allows with a nod how that is so. My mother's fingers are now turning in the curls behind my ears. Not that I even know it at the time, or that she does. Being stroked is my life, stroking me, my father, and my brother is hers. My brother goes off to a Boy Scout council meeting, but only after my father has him stand in his neckerchief before Dr. Kafka and describe to him the skills he has mastered to earn each of his badges. I am invited to bring my stamp album into the living room and show Dr. Kafka my set of triangular stamps from Zanzibar. Zanzibar, says my father rapturously, as though I, not even 10, have already been there and back. My father accompanies Dr. Kafka and myself into the sun parlor where my tropical fish swim in the aerated, heated, and hygienic paradise I have made for them with my weekly allowance and my Hanukkah gelt. I am encouraged to tell Dr. Kafka what I know about the temperament of the angelfish, the function of the catfish, and the family life of the black molly. I know quite a bit. All on his own he does that, my father says to Kafka. He gives me a lecture on one of those fish. It's 7th heaven, Dr. Kafka. I can imagine, Kafka replies. Back in the living room, my Aunt Rhoda suddenly launches into a rather recondite monologue on Scotch plaids, designed, as it would appear, only for the edification of my mother. At least she looks fixedly at my mother when she delivers it. I have not yet seen her look directly at Dr. Kafka. She did not even turn his way at dinner when he asked how many employees there were at the Big Bear. How would I know, she replies, and continues conversing with my mother, something about a grocer or a butcher who would take care of her under the counter if she could find him nylons for his wife. It never occurs to me that she will not look at Dr. Kafka because she is shy. Nobody that dolled up could, in my estimation, be shy. I can only think that she is outraged. It's his breath. It's his accent. It's his age. I'm wrong. It turns out to be what Aunt Rhoda calls his superiority complex. "Sitting there sneering at us like that," says my aunt, somewhat superior now herself. "Sneering," repeats my father, incredulous. "Sneering and laughing, yes," says Aunt Rhoda. My mother shrugs. "I didn't think he was laughing." "Oh, don't worry, by himself there he was, having a very good time, at our expense. I know the European-type man. Underneath they think they're all lords of the manor," Rhoda says. "You know something, Rhoda," says my father, tilting his head and pointing a finger. "I think you fell in love." "With him? Are you crazy?" "He's too quiet for Rhoda," my mother says. "I think maybe he's a little bit of a wallflower. Rhoda is a lively person. She needs lively people around her." "Wallflower? He's not a wallflower. He's a gentleman, that's all, and he's lonely," my father says assertively, glaring at my mother for coming in over his head like this against Kafka. My Aunt Rhoda is 40 years old. It is not exactly a shipment of brand new goods that he's trying to move. "He is a gentleman. He's an educated man, and I'll tell you something. He'd give his eye teeth to have a nice home and a wife." "Well," says my Aunt Rhoda, "let him find one, then, if he's so educated. Somebody who's his equal, who he doesn't have to look down his nose at with his big, sad refugee eyes." "Yep, she's in love," my father announces, squeezing Rhoda's knee in triumph. "With him?" she cries, jumping to her feet, taffeta crackling around her like a bonfire. "With Kafka?" she snorts. "I wouldn't give an old man like him the time of day." Dr. Kafka calls and takes my Aunt Rhoda to a movie. I'm astonished, both that he calls and that she goes. It seems there's more desperation in life than I have come across yet in my fish tank. Dr. Kafka takes my Aunt Rhoda to a play performed at the Y. Dr. Kafka eats Sunday dinner with my grandmother and my Aunt Rhoda, and at the end of the afternoon accepts with that formal bow of his the mason jar of barley soup that my grandmother presses on him to carry back to his room with him on the number 8 bus. Apparently he was very taken with my grandmother's jungle of potted plants, and she, as a result, with him. Together they spoke in Yiddish about gardening. One Wednesday morning, only an hour after the store has opened for the day, Dr. Kafka shows up at the dry goods department of the Big Bear, and he tells Aunt Rhoda that he just wanted to see where she worked. That night, he writes in his diary, "With the customers, she is forthright and cheery, and so managerial about taste, that when I hear her explain to a chubby young bride why green and blue do not go, I am myself ready to believe that nature is in error and R is correct." One night at 10, Dr. Kafka and Aunt Rhoda come by unexpectedly, and a small impromptu party is held in the kitchen, coffee and cake, even a thimbleful of whiskey all around, to celebrate the resumption of Aunt Rhoda's career on the stage. I have only heard tell of my aunt's theatrical ambitions. My brother says that when I was small she used to come to entertain the two of us on Sundays with her puppets. She was at that time employed by the WPA to travel around New Jersey and put on puppet shows in schools and even in churches. Aunt Rhoda did all the voices, male and female, and with the help of another girl manipulated the mannequins on their strings. Simultaneously, she has been a member of the Newark Collective Theater, a troupe organized primarily to go around to strike groups to perform Waiting for Lefty. Everybody in Newark, as I understood it, had had high hopes that Rhoda Pilchick would go on to Broadway, everybody except my grandmother. To me, this period of history is as difficult to believe in as the era of the lake dwellers that I am studying in school. Of course, people say it was once so I believe them. But nonetheless, it's hard to grant such stories the status of the real, given the life I see around me. Yet my father, a very avid realist, is in the kitchen, schnapps glass in hand, toasting Aunt Rhoda's success. She has been awarded one of the starring roles in the Russian masterpiece The Three Sisters, to be performed 6 weeks hence by the amateur group at the Newark Y. "Everything," announces Aunt Rhoda, "everything she owes to Franz, and his encouragement. One conversation, one," she cries gaily, and Dr. Kafka had apparently talked my grandmother out of her lifelong belief that actors are not serious human beings. "And what an actor he is in his own right," says Aunt Rhoda. How he had opened her eyes to the meaning of things by reading her the famous Chekhov play. Yes, read it to her from the opening line to the final curtain, all the parts, and actually left her in tears. "Here," Aunt Rhoda says, "listen, listen. This is the first line of the play. It is the key to everything. Listen. I just think about what it was like that night Pop passed away, how I thought and thought what would happen, what would we all do, and listen. We're listening, laughs my father. Pause. She must have walked to the center of the kitchen linoleum, she says, sounding a little surprised. It's just a year ago today that Father died. Shh, warns my mother. You'll give the little one nightmares. I am not alone in finding my aunt a changed person during the ensuing weeks of rehearsal. My mother says this is just what she was like as a little girl. Red cheeks, always, those hot red cheeks, and everything exciting, even taking a bath. She'll calm down, don't worry, says my father, and then he'll pop the question. Knock on wood, says my mother. Come on, says my father, he knows what side his bread is buttered on. He sets foot in this house, he sees what a family's all about, and believe me, he's licking his chops. Just look at him when he sits in that club chair. This is his dream come true. Rhoda says that in Berlin, before Hitler, he had a young girlfriend. Years and years it went on, and then she left him. For somebody else. She got tired of waiting. Don't worry, says my father. When the time comes, I'll give him a little nudge. He ain't going to live forever, either, and he knows it. Then one weekend, as a respite from the strain of nightly rehearsals, which Dr. Kafka regularly visits, watching in his hat and coat from a seat at the back of the auditorium until it is time to accompany Aunt Rhoda home, they take a trip to Atlantic City. Ever since he arrived on these shores, Dr. Kafka has wanted to see the famous boardwalk and the horse that dives from the high board. But in Atlantic City, something happens that I'm not allowed to know about. Any discussion of the subject conducted in my presence is in Yiddish. Dr. Kafka sends Aunt Rhoda 4 letters in 3 days. She comes to us for dinner and sits till midnight crying in our kitchen. She calls the Y on our phone to tell them, weeping, that her mother is still ill and she cannot come to rehearsal again. She may even have to drop out of the play. No, she can't, she can't. Her mother is too ill. She herself is too upset. Goodbye. Then back to the kitchen table to cry. She wears no pink powder and no red lipstick, and her stiff brown hair, down, is thick and spiky as a new broom. My brother and I listen from our bedroom through the door that silently he has pushed ajar. Have you ever, says Aunt Rhoda, weeping, have you ever? Poor soul, says my mother. Who, I whisper to my brother, Aunt Rhoda or? Shh, he says, shut up. In the kitchen, my father grunts. I hear him getting up and walking around and sitting down again, and then grunting. I am listening so hard that I can hear the letters being folded and unfolded, stuck back into their envelopes, and then removed to be puzzled over one more time. Well, demands Aunt Rhoda. Well? Well, what? Answers my father. Well, what do you want me to say now? He's meshuggah, admits my father. Something is wrong with him, all right. But, sobs Aunt Rhoda, no one would believe me when I said it. Rhody, Rhody, croons my mother in that voice I know from those times that I have had to have stitches taken, or when I awaken in tears somehow on the floor beside my bed. Rhody, don't be hysterical, darling. It's over, kitten. It's all over. I reach across to my brother's twin bed and tug on the blanket. I don't think I've ever been so confused in my life, not even by death. The speed of things. Everything good undone in a moment. By what? What, I whisper. What is it? My brother, the Boy Scout, smiles leeringly and with fierce hiss that is no answer and enough answer, addresses my bewilderment. Sex. Years later, a junior at college, I receive an envelope from home containing Dr. Kafka's obituary, clipped from the Jewish News, the tabloid of Jewish affairs that is mailed each week to the homes of the Jews of Essex County. It is summer, the semester is over, but I have stayed on at school, alone in my room in the town, trying to write short stories. I am fed by a young English professor and his wife in exchange for babysitting. I tell the sympathetic couple, who are also loaning me the money for my rent, why it is I can't go home. My tearful fights with my father are all I can talk about at their dinner table. Keep him away from me, I scream at my mother. But, darling, she asks me, what is going on? What is this all about? The very same question with which I used to plague my older brother, asked of me now out of the same bewilderment and innocence. He loves you, she explains. But that, of all things, seems to me to be precisely what is blocking my way. Others are crushed by paternal criticism. I find myself oppressed by his high opinion of me. Can it possibly be true, and can I possibly admit, that I am coming to hate him for loving me so, praising me so? But that makes no sense. The ingratitude, the stupidity, the contrariness. Being loved is so obviously a blessing, the blessing. Praise, such a rare bequest. Only listen late at night to my closest friends on the literary magazine and in the drama society, and they tell me horror stories of family life to rival the way of all flesh. They return shell-shocked from vacations, drift back to school as though from the wars. What they would give to be in my golden slippers. What's going on? My mother begs me to tell her. But how can I, when I can neither fully believe that this is happening to us, nor that I am the one who's making it happen? That they, who together cleared all obstructions from my path, should seem now to be my final obstruction. No wonder my rage must filter through a child's tears of shame, confusion, and loss. All that we have constructed together over the course of 2-century-long decades, and look how I must bring it down, in the name of this tyrannical need that I call my independence. Born, I am told, with the umbilical cord around my neck, it seems I will always come close to strangulation trying to deliver myself from my past into my future. My mother, keeping the lines of communication open, sends a note to me at school. We miss you, and encloses a very brief obituary notice. Across the margin at the bottom of the clipping she has written, in the same hand that she wrote notes to my teacher and signed my report cards, in the very same handwriting that once eased my way in the world. Remember poor Kafka, Aunt Rhoda's beau? Dr. Franz Kafka, the notice reads, a Hebrew teacher at the Talmud Torah of the Schley Street Synagogue from 1939 to 1948, died on June 3rd in the Deborah Tuberculosis Sanatorium in Browns Mill, New Jersey. Dr. Kafka had been a patient there since 1950. He was 70 years old. Dr. Kafka was born in Prague, Czechoslovakia, and was a refugee from the Nazis. He leaves no survivors. He also leaves no books, no trial, no castle, no diaries. The dead man's papers are claimed by no one and disappear, all except those 4 Meshuggah letters that are, to this day, as far as I know, still somewhere in amongst the memorabilia accumulated in her dresser drawers by my spinster aunt, along with a collection of Broadway playbills, sales citations from the Big Bear, and transatlantic steamship stickers. Thus all trace of Dr. Kafka disappears. Destiny being destiny, how could it be otherwise? Does the land surveyor reach the castle? Does Kay escape the judgment of the court? Or George Bendeman the judgment of his father? Well, clear this out now, said the overseer, and they buried the hunger artist, straw and all. No, it simply is not in the cards for Kafka ever to become the Kafka. Why, that would be stranger even than that man turning into an insect. No one would believe it, Kafka least of all. And that story was I Always Wanted You to Admire My Fasting or Looking at Kafka by Philip Roth from The Treasury of American Short Stories, edited by Nancy Sullivan. You are listening to Classic and Contemporary Short Stories on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm Linda Primavera. The next story is from Sun Fiction American Short Stories, edited by Robert Shepard and James Thomas. Song on Royal Street by Richard Blessing. Ah, go buy yourself a set of legs, he snarls at the chubby black dachshund who waddles after them, barking. Willow Street, remember, she says. Could it be the same dog? After 13 years, and this one almost a puppy? All right, then, she says. It's the puppy of the same one. They are walking the streets of New Orleans, the University District, on a night heavy with rain-like mist. The dog stops to sniff the trunk of a mimosa, and they walk on under the broad-leaved trees. The scent of a honeysuckle is everywhere. Old age, he says, ain't it great? Come on, she says, 40 isn't old age. He is conscious of added weight at the middle, flesh under the jawline. He thinks how well she has aged. The blonde hair is curled now, short and becoming, and the body is fuller, a woman's body and not a girl's. It's just nothing is like we planned, he said, like I planned. Nothing ever is for anybody, but has it been so bad? Tulane Stadium rises out of the mist like a cathedral in some history book, dwarfing the houses for blocks around. "Not for you, maybe," he says. "You have the boy." "Look," she says, "the stadium. Remember that Thanksgiving in the French Quarter Motel and then we came up here for the game?" "I remember. Tulane lost. I don't remember the game." "Ah," he says, "thank you for that." For a moment they drift together, shoulders touching. "I miss this city," he says. "It's not so bad," she says. "We have a happy kid, a healthy one." "You have." "Don't say that," she says. "He misses you, he does, but he understands." Crickets chirp in the dark grass. Her heels are lower these days, he notices. Sensible shoes make her seem smaller, diminished. She barely reaches his shoulder. "Do you believe in magic?" he asks. "There was that old Negro woman on Royal Street, oh, way back when we were just beginning. She wanted money, remember?" "No." "She wanted money, and I walked away. You must remember. She came up behind us then and took my hand, and she sang something. You remember?" "No." "And after I had to sit down, I felt that sick and dizzy. You said it was nerves. You said it was not eating. You said I was making it up, imagining things." "I don't remember." "After that, we were never happy." "I don't remember." "All right," he says, "all right. Anyway, we have a healthy kid." "That's a lot." "That's something." "Yes." They turn up McAllister Drive, passing the brick dormitories, the broad shadowed quadrangles. It is late summer. The students have all gone home. He bends his head, passing under the mimosas, the low-hanging boughs. "Was there really a black woman?" she asks. "I had to sit down. I was that sick. And the next day we found out you were pregnant. Remember now? And then things just happened like they happened. She sang a song on Royal Street." "I remember you were scared, like a boy. I remember you wanted the baby dead." "No." "There are ways," you said. "I know people," you said. "No, the Negro woman. She sang a song and I got sick." "You wanted him dead. I don't remember a woman." They have come to a corner, the street lamps glimmering through the heavy leaves of trees. A bus flashes past and disappears into mist and dark. "Look," he says, "the ferret jet. We rode that enough times." "Boy, the ferret jet. I remember that." "I think you made that up," she says, "about the black woman." "After she sang, you never made it," he says, "not one time." "I was morning sick." "Not one time." "She didn't take my hand. She never sang to me." "You remember then?" "No." He drives his fist against the stop sign and sinks to one knee in pain. He looks up at her. "There was a woman," he says slowly. "She took my hand. On Royal Street. She sang a song." "She never took my hand." "I was never any good again. Not once. I was sick with Chris, and then Daddy died. Lots of people die. Not like that, not so horribly. But never again." "Not never," she says. "Just never for you." "Liar," he says. "Never again in your life." She turns to him then, and her eyes burn through the mist. "All right," she says. "All right. I remember the woman. She was horrible, all wrinkles and bad smell. When she took your hand, her eyes shone red in the dark like a swamp animal." "No," he says, "she was just an old beggar. When she crooned, there was death in her voice. She made you a dead man, and you didn't know." "I don't remember." "You remember all right. After that, touching you was a nightmare. You stunk of the grave, a dead man walking around. Look at you. You're more dead than my father." "There was never a woman, or not like that. I made her up, an excuse." "No, after that, I never came with you, remember?" "No." "She was old and horrible, and you wouldn't give her money. She touched you with her putrefying hand. She put a spell on you on Royal Street. I never made it again, not with you. Everyone else, never with you." "I made her up." "No." "Stop crying." "I can't. I don't have anything, not even my boy." "Stop crying. You never came, not once. You were afraid." "Not once." "When I touched you," she says, "I was touching death." He sits down on the cold stone of the gymnasium stairs. She moves in and out of focus, like someone seen through poorly adjusted binoculars. "The black woman," he says. "Yes," she says, "the black woman." No, he says, it was your hand, your song. All right, she says, all right. We have a fine son. Yes, he says, that's a lot. That's everything. He isn't even yours, she says. And that story was Song on Royal Street by Richard Blessing from Sun Fiction American Short Stories, edited by Robert Shepard and James Thomas. And now from Pushcart Prize Volume 37 from the year 2013, edited by Bill Henderson. A Fable for Our Anniversary by Alan Michael Parker. You asked to be surprised, so I traded our last sack of rice for a little knife curved into a question. The knife for a bit of cloth embroidered by a prisoner. The cloth for a monkey who was never nice. The monkey for a bowl of sayings. The sayings for a pair of silver candlesticks. The candlesticks for a goose. The goose bit the dogs in the courtyard, so I traded the goose for a pink bonnet that makes the wearer invisible. Who would want to be invisible? I traded the bonnet for a sheaf of wheat that shone in the garden for a little while. Like a giant piece of golden jewelry, the wheat for a desk, solid as a bad idea, the desk for a couple of tickets to a show. Love, we could go to the show, but the show would end. I traded the show tickets for an old trousseau, the linens flush with lavender, because I knew a man who would give me a magic goat for the smells kept between those sheets. But first the man made me fetch a cup of coffee from the deli, which I did. Cream, no sugar, an epic quest. It was one of those dawns that didn't and then was. The crows were calling in their office across the street, all that old business of the soul and such, but don't you worry. I wasn't scared, and now I have a goat. I lead him home, pat his head, and say the words I'm supposed to say. Careful, those words are powerful, until the goat begins to float into the air, bleating a bit and huffing outside our bedroom window. Wake up, sweetie. We've been married for 25 years. I brought you a magic floating goat. And that was A Fable for Our Anniversary by Alan Michael Parker, from Pushcart Prize, Volume 37, from the year 2013, edited by Bill Henderson. And that's the end of our Classic and Contemporary Short Stories program for today. If you miss a program, you can access it on demand at sunsounds.org. Click on Broadcast Info and Audio, then under Programming Links, left-click on On-Demand Podcasts. You can also listen to Sunsounds on your Echo Dot or other smart home device. I'm Linda Primavera, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. Thanks for joining me, and bye for now.